It's 15 past again, so lecture number 7 about functional programming begins. So today, this is our agenda for today. First, we have a bunch of administrative stuff about the course, about things around the course, which will unfortunately consume some 10 minutes or so. Then we discover a new language feature called type classes, which is pretty much Haskell specific today. It's there were plans of including this feature into C++, the next version of that language, and it has these appearances in Scala or a few other languages, but they all work a bit differently from Haskell, and this is one of the nice features of the language. Then we encounter one of these type classes, specific type class called a functor, which is a great tool. It's one of the awesome things in Haskell. And then we discuss a bit about functor laws and how to use that. So this is again one of those lectures that we answer these questions. When I introduce a new language feature, it's easy to make questions and easy to check if you understand the questions by answering them. And yeah, but first, I have this interesting data request, and I have misspelled the university name. But anyways, one PhD student from University of Lafayette asked me to share your exercise texts, or those exercises that you submit into your into the web exercise system. So basically what they are doing, as I understood, is that they are trying to improve programming language usability, and they want this big corpus of data, a big bunch of small programs, to see what kind of mistakes people make. And then they would like to improve the languages in a way that mistakes are less prominent. In general, doing stuff like this is a good thing. It's nice that someone does this. And basically what I'm asking you is that if it's okay for me to share your, you know, exercise texts with these guys. Basically, I would rip out your name, give out what you have written in the exercise system, and just give those guys that as a data, which they can mine and figure out any special features inside, point out that most Haskell programmers tend to make this kind of a mistake, things like this. And this is basically something that I would really want everyone to answer. If you say no here, then I won't give out your data. If you say yes, I will take out your name and pass it on. I don't think this is harmful for anyone. So you really don't lose anything, I think, if you accept. You can't probably make any money out of your exercises or anything. So might be nice to do. But during this lecture, please answer this question so I can just make an informed decision. Next, Antti-Juhani got an anonymous feedback, which is always great since it's nice that you criticize the course during the course and not just after the course. One person complained with quite harsh tones that the course is too hard. Well, that's just one person, so I made a survey. You can fill it in. And basically, I got 10 answers for my survey. Most people think that the course is okay. It's a bit hard. Well, programming courses are supposed to be a bit hard, so it's all right. But 10 answers is way too little to make any kind of an informed decision. So, you know, I urge everyone to fill in that survey, because if you don't, nothing will ever change, and if you are uncomfortable with the workload, then, you know, nothing will ever change. And someone wanted to download the course text. Well, you can, if you want. But Antti-Juhani had something to say about the workload, about courses. And I think this is interesting for all of us. One question first. Oh yeah, I forgot the HTTP. I will fix it later, but it will be there. But Antti-Juhani.
Okay, some comments generally about course workloads. Student workloads. Someone commented in, I think, in the survey that it would be nice, it should be that course workload should be based on statistical data on what students actually can perform. That's nice. We would want to do that, but we can't get that kind of data. Look at this. We have 150 students on this course. We have 10 answers. That is not statistically relevant sample. We cannot make any kind of useful analysis of that data. And that is how it usually happens. We never get enough answers. We never get a statistically representative sample. So we cannot make that kind of a call based on the actual answers. We would like to do that, but we can't. So we have to just make an educated guess about what you can do. Another problem that I have noticed on many other courses and also in these answers is that, and this is not your fault, this is not our fault personally, it's the fault of the system in this university, is that in this period there are enough hours for someone to take about 3 courses of 5 credits worth. I think I would ask you, how many of you are taking at most 15 credits in this period? How many are taking more? How many are taking more than 20? Okay, yeah. So, okay, that was actually very nice. Not very bad, but it often creates the kind of situation where you feel that it's too hard. Well, yeah, it's too hard because we are requiring you to study too much, but not at the individual course level, but at how we structure the course year. And that's the 2 things I wanted to mention.
Yeah, so I guess this can be summarized. Drop the other courses and study this one. Well, okay, not seriously. But anyways, 10 answers. I try my best to react to any feedback, so I get useful feedback. And I asked in the survey also, what should I do? And here are the suggestions that I got from the first 10 people. Please make other suggestions. And basically, I bring this up because, you know, I want you to be treated fairly in this course. These are not arbitrary decisions why we have these course components. Most common request was to drop the lecture questions, especially if you are a remote student, you wouldn't want to write up the lecture questions. Yeah, this won't happen because it would be a bit unfair to people who are actually attending the lectures. And also it would be unfair to the remote students who will eventually fall out of base if there's nothing to base their work. This might not apply to any individual student, but since we are working with, you know, 150 students, we have to have these general guidelines that are good for the herd of students instead of just single student. Also, I'm a bit surprised that people find the lecture questions hard because, you know, I explain the answers during the lectures. So it shouldn't be that hard to, you know, answer them if you are a remote student. Second request was to do away with the deadlines. Well, since there are only deadlines for these lecture questions, well, it wouldn't really work if you just submit them on the final day of the course. It would be totally useless exercise to do at that point. So that won't happen. And it's about this mass course and pacing. There are people who, single people, probably don't benefit from the deadlines, but the whole course will benefit. I get more students through the course if there are, you know, few deadlines here and there. Third request was to, you know, relax and not actually require all the exercise to be correct. This is my personal stance. Well, what sense would it make to accept exercises that are wrong? What good would it do to the student to make wrong answers to exercises? So, won't happen either, or at least you have to be, you know, very convincing for me to make that change. What can happen? Someone asked for more supervised sessions. Yes, we are happy to have more supervised sessions, and you can even book these personal times, you know, one-on-one time with me, or so we can figure out if you have any difficulties. So please let me know. If you want more, just answer the survey and say more supervised sessions, and there will be more supervised sessions. Less exercises. Well, like Antti-Juhani said, we have really no data about how, you know, how many hours does this consume. So if you answer the survey, you think the workload is too high, or I think the workload is too high based on your answers, yeah, we could have less exercises. Why there are so many? Well, practice makes perfect. And I have to uphold this certain level of standard that you pass this course. So if you pass this course by doing 3 exercises and learning nothing, that's really harmful for you. You know, I get pat on my head from the dean because he likes students to pass the courses. But it would be unfair to you when you have to compete with other programmers from other universities. So we have to have the standard up here and not here. Balance between weeks. Yeah, some weeks are harder than others. We'll fix, but can't do much for the, you know, this course. Okay, if you have any comments, fill out the survey and, you know, write them there. This is just my current view of this too hard, too easy thing. Any immediate comments? Yeah, yes. Oh, great, thanks. But how would I make this? We had this one case where we asked students to fill out the course feedback form, and that was a requisite for passing the course. And that's apparently something that we are not strictly allowed to do. So at best, I could make an exercise about filling this survey, and even then someone could complain. But please do. I will look at you angrily if you don't, although I have no means of knowing whether you did or not, since it's anonymous.
One thing that's about that lecture questions.
Yeah.
It can be put in that website that during the theory, and then maybe it's more benefit because it would give that person to think deeply instead of like spending time during the lectures, and it just give you more time to explain the concepts. That's why what I'm thinking. You don't have to drop it, but put it in the theory and let the student, while they're reading the theory materials, answer.
Could be. I will take that under consideration at least. Okay, so final note. Based on the survey questions, I think there are few people who have misunderstood how you pass the course. So one thing, you have to try each exercise before the lecture. You don't have to complete them. You have to be able to discuss about these questions during the lecture. So try, don't have to complete. Still, you don't need to get all the stars from all the exercises. Might be good for you if you do, but you know, if you don't have this red cross, then your exercise is passed. You don't need to get all the stars. Finally, some people have missed this part. You can have partial credit. So if it seems that your workload is too high, based on other courses, just take 2 or 3 credits and continue later. It's fine, just fine. And finally, the deadline is, you know, late, so you will have time to fill in missing parts if you need. And if you need, we can extend the supervised sessions, I think. Yes? So yeah, the scenario, you do 4 credits now, then come back next year and you do only the exercise for 5th credit and you get 5 credits. So we are flexible. I think we are more flexible than almost any other course in this faculty in this regard. So then on positive note, a few more administrative facts. Traditionally, those people who pass the Functional Programming 2 course, almost half of them usually get employed immediately in various projects. Mostly something like, you know, less than 10 people usually pass that. But anyways, it's a, you know, employment opportunity.
Promising.
Yeah. However, the Functional Programming 2 is delayed until fall. I won't be here to teach it. And there is something like 25% probability, actually more than that, I calculated slightly wrong, that I won't be here next week, so I have to give you these opportunities now. So the sieve is not so thin at this point, it's easier. So a few early opportunities. If you need money or credits. If you like biology, you would like to be a biology student, but you know that biology students, they never get employed unless they are really, really awesome students. Well, if you're a computer science student, you can get employed in biology. So we have this long project about counting algae, figuring out how much biomass is there in Finnish lakes. This is actually important research, and we are trying to make it better. Currently, it's really hard for the guy who's looking through at the lens and counting individual single-celled organisms, like 800 on this slide. It's a gruesome work. So we would like to make all kinds of improvements to this process. In the end, we have an efficient, human-friendly means of computing biomasses in lakes. And we have, probably cost something like 10 or 20 biologists to lose their jobs, but that's an unfortunate side effect. This pays some money, not that much, but it's good master's thesis, licensed thesis, or even a PhD thesis if you want. So you get credits and a bit of money if you want to do this. That's for one person. Another thing, if you wanted to be a doctor but failed and ended up here, you can still, improve healthcare. There is this idea that computer science, big data, and IT in general in healthcare will be, one of the big things in next decade. And we have this small project here, which is basically computer languages and thinking about processes. There's currently no initial strategy for treating patients in Finland. So you go to a doctor and he makes some decisions, sends you to the next guy, and no one has an overall picture of what is supposed to happen to you. And there's this bunch of people who are trying to fix this, and they are designing a language about describing the treatment processes for human beings. And yeah, this is paid by hour. It's designing a markup language. It sounds like fun. And you can get credits from this. So if you want to apply, send me an email, both of these jobs. And finally, if you are rich enough and don't need money, credits will do fine. Then come and ask me. I have huge amount of work that you can do to improve this course or the programming one or two courses. There's a million little things that you can do, and I can arrange for something like 5 to 8 credits. If you do something really nice, it could be a master's thesis. But if you want credits for basically, you want to program and get credits, this is one option. Any questions about these, just send me an email. Okay, done with the administrative, boring, useless stuff, and on to the topic. Type classes. What are type classes? And how they are defined and how they are used. Well, here's the syntax. Here's one simple example. I had no real good example, so it's a type class called Wibble. And it defines two methods or constraint functions. Basically, there's Wibble, which turns A into list of A, and Wobble, which does the opposite. So what are the things that we have here? This is a class declaration. It says that there is a new class. This is a name, Wibble. That's the part that is on the left-hand side of the fat arrow. So think egg, odd, num, and things like this. This is how you define those things. A is the thing that is of the class Wibble. And then there are these type class methods. Basically, in the class declaration, we just tell what the type should be. Here we also could have default implementations. If there would be some default Wobble method, for example, we could write something like head. If you don't define Wobble, it's the same as taking head of the list. Well, very bad choice, but you could do that. Then type classes, though the Haskell compiler doesn't care about this, usually come with some set of laws. So we have this contract of how the class instances should behave. And in this imaginary case, we demand that if you wibble x and then wobble it, then you get the same x. So this is an identity function if you compose these two together. So these are the things that go into the class declaration. Then we have the instance declarations. which is basically you say instance the class, the type you wish to use in the class, and then you get to write the actual code for these functions. Basically, at this point, whatever was here, this A, gets turned into whatever is here. So we get int to list of ints, and from list of ints to ints. And here we have this small historical problem that Haskell doesn't allow to write type declarations at this point. So you have to either enable a language extension or make comments. But if you are making class instances, you really have to, you know what the types are. So write them in comments if you don't figure them out otherwise. Yeah, I have Wibble int and Wibble list of A's. That's how you define a type class. Okay, again, short question. Which of these, what does the previous slide enable me to do? So basically, what kind of functions or what types of things can I define? Everyone probably has a web browser, so you can check the previous slide when you need. This is only about syntax now. Why you can't zoom on the slides? Well, I didn't write the slide engine. It's called reveal.js, and it's unzoomable by design. So I have no idea how to configure it so that it works for that use case. But anyway, that's something if you want to write better slide engine for me, yeah, I can give you credits for that. So that would be a nice project. Yes. Okay, so they are so small that it's almost unanswerable. Yeah, let me see if I can. Okay, this is probably the ugliest solution for the contrast problem, but here are the choices in Notepad of all things. Okay, to make time for the group discussion, I think we have cut off in 20 answers for this. So 4 more answers and we can proceed. Yeah, great. It seems that this... I think quite okay. Let's make a short group discussion anyways. So, which of you can write? You can write and go ahead. Tämä. Joo. The horrible gong sound is still here. Have to fix that. Okay, so let's go over these answers. Well, first one. Unfortunately, majority of you are mistaken in this. If you have this ordinary arrow, it says that we have this kind of a type, which we map into this kind of a type using this function. We don't have a type called Wibble. It's not a type, it's a constraint. Especially here, we should have a type constructor, Wibble A, like maybe A, for example, or list of A's. It's the same kind of a thing. However, what type classes define are constraints. So Wibble is a constraint. It can be placed on the left of the fat arrow. So this one is okay. Everyone almost knows this is what you have to write. Wibble is a constraint, not a type. Definitely Wibble without the A is not a type. It's you know, a name of a constraint. Doesn't belong here. It's totally different order of thing. Correct. And finally, this one. Can I write string to int using Wibble? So I Wibble the string and then take the length of the Wibbled string. Can I do this? Well, only things that I can use this Wibble function for are ints and lists of whatever. And what are strings? Strings are lists of characters. So this instance holds. So what happens? I call this Wibble with a string, which is list of characters. It's going to make a list that contains the reverse of the initial string, and then compute the length. So this works, and the answer is 1. Because you are taking a length of a list of length 1. Okay, how clear is this? Okay, let's try the next one. We can actually come back to this if it's going to be difficult. Or let me ask this straight still. Would you benefit from another small discussion about this? Would it make it clearer? No. So let's continue. I think it's quite clear. It's not a type, it's a constraint. You can't write a constraint in the type other than on the left of the fat arrow. Okay, next topic. And as a prerequisite to the next actual type class topic, we have this terminology question. Given this usual definition of the either type, which of these strings of characters I've written here, which of these are types in Haskell? Which of these are things that you could write, for example, in the left side of an arrow? So, which of these are types? Cutoff is at 20 answers, and then we proceed to the group discussion. Basically think, can I write a function either arrow int? Can I write a function either string int? And so on. Which of these would be sensible? Okay, 20 answers. So basically, it seems that you mostly know what I'm talking about, I think. At least the general tendency is very good. So anyone brave enough to tell me why either is, why you said no for the first one? Well, what is either if it's not a type? What is it then? Yeah, it's a type constructor. It is thing that makes types. If you give it two arguments, you get a type. If you give it one argument, well, it's still a type constructor. It would construct new types if you supply another argument for it. Finally, type variables are okay as types. So even though you can use this type and replace the A with whatever type you like, this is still a proper type. It's just a polymorphic type. And I think this is clear enough for everyone. Yeah. So this is the important fact for the next question. So basically, we have this notation in Haskell. So either is star, arrow, star, arrow, star. Basically, add two types and you make a type. Either string is arrow, star, arrow, star. So add single type to make a full type. And single star means it's just a type. So if you see a printout from GHC that has these stars, that is, it uses them to measure the arity of the type constructors. Basically, similar thing as normal functions, but stars instead of names. So then we have this stronger thing that used to be called type constructor classes or constructor classes. And it works like this. We have a class declaration, just as before. We have type variable, but then in these functions or the types that the class supports, f is not a type, but a type constructor. So you can put a type constructor in place of f. And this is quite valid. It's not a smart class. This is a bit of silly class. It's a class of all containers that contain, some A that you can ask how much is there inside of this container. And you can ask, give me an example of stuff inside this container. For example, hash capacity list would be nice. So capacity of list, probably the same as length of the list. Example, well, that could be the first element of the list if it exists. And binary trees, whatever containers, they would all probably fit to this class declaration. And then always you should think about the laws of the type class. Here we say that, if the capacity is more than zero, then I can pull out an example of that container. Bit silly type class, but looks like this. Important point, f is a type constructor. So which of these can I write? Same question as before, mostly. No, vastaa ajatuksissa ja sitten muistuttaa minua, että mä laitan sen merkinnän sinne, niin ei tule ongelma. Anyone else have trouble with this answering this? Yeah. This is, yeah. So okay, it's a formatting problem, I think. Since we have this gray background for code examples, the colored part that you usually get by answering is behind this. Something that I should fix if I remember to do it, but it will work. It just doesn't seem like it's working. When the answers again, so we get a first glimpse of what's your... Okay. Yeah, 30 answers, does it change? Okay. What we can see here is that most of you think you can't write this hash capacity either. Yeah, you cannot write it because, well, obviously, this either here, it replaces the f in the declaration. So if you replace f by either, you end up with thing that is something like this. Yeah, we get this if we replace, you know, f with either. And like we just discussed, this is not a type. You can't write a type constructor on left of the arrow. So with this knowledge, try the same question in groups. I gave you one answer. This is truly false. This doesn't happen. But check the rest with, you know, in groups. Okay. So, most of you were awake, I guess. Then, still a bit vague, still a bit vague. Hash capacity int. I can't write this. But why can't I write this? Because the capacity, it's defined like f of a arrow int. Now, like I said before, what this definition does is it allows us to replace the int in place of f in the upper definition. So we could get a type like this int of a arrow int. Now the only problem is that int is a type and not a type constructor. So int doesn't take arguments. So int a, well, int just an int. It's not something that constructs a new type. So this won't work. Either, well, that won't work for the reason I said a few minutes ago. Either string, this will work because I replace it in place of the f. And I get this. I have either string a arrow int. This is a proper type. Previous questionnaire, you all figured out that this is a proper type. So if this is a proper type, this is a nice proper function. So this one will work. Finally, if we replace it with the last selection, oh no, we have either string int a, which does not work because the type constructor either only takes two arguments, and now it's given three. Okay, and I'm going to pester you with this a bit more. I'm going to, you know, have you discuss for another 1 minute about this with your friends and change your answer. So when this counts down to, say, 100, then we stop. Yes, you can answer again. That's all. It only saves your final answers. Or that's the thing I check to calculate if it's 30% correct. Yeah, if you can't answer again, reload the page and it will allow you to answer again. Okay, based on the sound, I think we are mostly done. Did you manage to change your answers, reloading the page and so on? Yeah, no, yes, no. Well, yeah, apparently most of you managed to change your answers correctly. So, you know, it's probably more clear if your friend explains the thing to you than if I explain it. You're all speaking the same language of students. So, okay, I guess this is clear. Any questions remaining of this type class? Yes?
Can I ask a question about the previous line? Like, people who just want more
Yeah.
Just one more. This one.
They are constructors, they are value constructors. And the either is a type constructor. So this part here, this is the type. This is the value level stuff. So a bit confusing, type constructor, value constructor. And you usually drop the prefix if it's clear. Yeah, thanks. Okay, then one thing that usually catches people by surprise is mixing recursion in type classes. And I'm not talking about making recursive functions that implement something in the type classes, but I'm talking about something like this. So we have yet another silly type class, probably not useful in the real world. It's called total size, and it takes something and computes an int based on that something. For example, we have, you know, total size of this unit type is 1, arbitrary. And if we have list of A, we can calculate total size if the thing inside the list also is of the class total size. So basically, you're going to read this on the other way around as well. In case A has instance for total size, in case this constraint holds, then this constraint will also hold. Meaning that, yeah, if I have list of something, some elements that I can compute the total size of, then I can compute the total size of this list by computing first the total sizes of the elements of the list and then summing them together. So basically, if I have lists of, you know, these unit types, say 3 of these inside of a list, then it will map them into list of 1, 1, 1, calculate the sum, ends up with 3. This is insanely powerful technique because you can, you know, use this to reduce the number of instances that you have to write. So for example here, we can calculate total size of this thing, list of these things, any kind of a combination of nested lists that contain these elements. So another important thing, in this definition, the total size function here, this is a function from list of A to int. Here, this total size function, not the same thing. It is a function from A to int. So basically here, it's a different function than we are defining. It's this function regards these elements and not the lists. Okay, these are details, and I think everyone can figure out many uses for this. And to check if we got it correctly. First 20 answers, and then we can progress. Which of these work? Which of these are valid invocations of function total size? Hint, this is not a very difficult question. Okay, we have the 20 answers. Yeah, quite right. The first one, well, rather obviously, because that is exactly what this last declaration says. We can compute total size for the type unit. Now that's correct. This one, is this correct? Well, we check the definitions. It's a list of unit. So it's a list of units, so it might be this one. This might work. list of A, A is a unit. Is A of class total size? Is the unit type in class total size? And yes, yes, it is. It's defined two lines after. But the rest? These and these. These are the things that we are unsure about. So basically follow this deduction. Here's the type that you are checking. Does this hold? If it holds, then you can compute the total size. And just recursively in your mind, fold it open. So in groups, use, oh, here's the timer, sorry. Okay, so great answer, I think. So total size, well, the first one we just, you know, said why this is possible. The second one, why is this possible? Well, firstly, what is the type of this blob here? Well, that's obviously a you know, a big nested list of, you know, unit types. Basically, if I use a sensible or more sensible type in place of unit type, it's analogous to this situation. Okay, back to the unit. Why doesn't Notepad have recursive undo? Well, anyways, does it have this? Is it of this class or does the constraint hold? Well, when would this constraint hold? Well, based on the definition, yeah, if the inner list is in the class of total size. So would this work? Well, same question again. Would it work? Well, is this inner list in this class? That's the question. Finally, we have list of something. Same recursive argument is the, you know, this A, which is now the unit. Is it of total size? Well, yeah. Obviously, yes, and because of this, yes, and because of that, yes, and because of this, yes, and the original claim holds. It works. Then, you know, this thing. Well, it's the list of units. It's this part, and we just deduced that that will work. Finally, total size for the empty list. What is the type of an empty list? Well, if we have no context around this, then it's probably list of A. Usually we have some context and the empty list has a meaningful type. And yeah, the answer is pretty much maybe. If we have strict definition of these things, and we assume that there's no context whatsoever, and that list actually is a list of A, then is list of A instance of total size? Well, is A of total size? And if we are so strict that we assume that there's nothing around this statement, then no, A is not in the class total size, so we can't call it. However, it's not wrong to say that you can call this, because, you know, if you interpret this that this is list of units, just an empty list of units, then you can make this call. But you have to supply a type or some other context to make sure that the list is actually list of units. I think this is quite clear. So, other way around. You can do this recursive constraint thingy in another place. This doesn't make this kind of a recursive definition, which allows you to cover many instances with few definitions. But it's interesting nonetheless. Fractional is one of the, you know, standard classes of the Haskell prelude, and it's defined approximately like this. We have this class constraint in the class definition, not the instance definition. And what this says is that, you know, you can define A to be a member of fractional class if A is also defined to be a number. So if I have something that is already in class num, I can extend it to class fractional by writing these instances for these three functions. If I have something like, say, Boolean, which is not in the class num, I can't make a fractional bool instance because of this constraint. So this has to hold before I can make the instance for this class. And this has interesting implications. This is a useful technique, less awesome than the previous one, but still useful. So what does the constraint in the class declaration mean? You know, first 20 answers. The options are, okay, I promised you one mistake in each set of slides. Here's my mistake. This should read real. This should be real. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. So, yeah, obviously, same type works the same type. Real A, int A. Other one is that if I have this function that works on reals, can I use it on nums? Basically, you know, can I change the constraint? Can I use it as if it had this constraint instead? Finally, if I define instance for oh dear. Yeah, I was very sleepy. None of the instances are wrong. Where this would be fractional instead of real or num. So if anyone answers this question wrong, it's my fault. So let's notepad it. So you can start answering. And Antti-Juhani did proofread my slides, so I'm not. Yeah, I thought you meant this. You have to check my ability to react to your feedback. Yeah, that's the one. Come on, this course can't be really hard for you since I learned the topic and I'm still doing this. Basically, first question, second question, third, and fourth question. What it should actually read as. Yeah. Sorry about this. It's my tendency of making these things. Once I had an interesting effect of this same idea. I was teaching how to make binary trees, binary search trees, where you have to have the left branches, all the numbers are smaller than on the right branch. And then I made an example picture which had random numbers, it's like big here, big there, didn't hold this at all. And then I was starting to teach how binary search trees work. And my example, it's just so wrong that there's nothing correct on the one slide. I don't think one class a few years back learned anything about binary search trees, but hey, life's that. Okay, five more answers to this confusingly broken question and we can move on. Okay, here's the 20. So, can I make them? Yeah. Almost there. I think we have pretty even split. To make sure, hands up if you didn't actually understand the question since I broke it so badly. Okay, yeah. Let's just forget about this. too broken to be useful. So the question what I intended to ask is that if I have, I have this from integer function, and then I'm writing code something like I have some f. I'm having a hard time of figuring what a reasonable function would there be. I am in place where I should use the from integer as, hey, I can figure out a more sensible example. Yeah, I have something like this. I have this polymorphic function, works on all fractional numbers. What it does is it's supposed to divide the number by 5. You know, you can imagine a more complicated formula in place of that. And the problem here is that I know that a is fractional. I can use the division operator with that. But then I need the constant 5. I need to divide by 5. Can I use the from integer method, which is basically defined on the first line here? It converts int to any type that is in the class num. Can I use that to implement this function that works over fractionals? That is the question. So the answer is, of course, yes, because writing this is something that you probably have already done when learning Haskell. Yeah, it obviously works. You probably haven't written the from integer part, because basically all numbers are polymorphic in this sense that, you know, the compiler will understand this number 5 there as, you know, from integral make this fractional number. So it's kind of the from integral part is in there, but it's invisible. And the answer is, of course, yes. This works. And why does it work? In the definition, if A is fractional, A also must be num. So I get this for free. This is exactly the same as what we had before. Fractional implies the existence of the num. So yeah, you can do it like this. However, if you try to do it the other way around, you have a num, which is basically your run-of-the-mill number, and you don't have for your numbers, let's say an int. Int is a num, but int is not fractional. Thus, we can't use the division operator with ints. It doesn't work that way. So fractional implies num, but num does not imply fractional. Also, the second question, if we are to define this kind of an instance, instance fractional foo, if we write that kind of an instance for any of our types, do we get the num instance for free? The answer is no, we don't get the num instance. We can't actually write this kind of an instance definition without first writing instance num foo somewhere. It's forbidden by the compiler. And yeah, horribly broken question. You know, I should probably start, you know, listening to Antti Juhani better. Yeah, anyways, sorry about that. Any questions about this recursive constraints in type classes? It's a very nice feature, especially the recursive instances. It really shortens the amount of code that you have to write. Okay, then few more topics. No more questions, I guess. One question. The next big topic is functors. These are both easy to learn. These are very simple. The name for them, like many Haskell things, it's really confusing. But this is the prime example of what kind of type classes exist in Haskell. type classes, they are very closely related to interfaces in object-oriented languages, like interfaces in Java or C#. And in those languages, you usually use interfaces to model your domain. You have your domain-specific objects, like you are doing a car dealership monitoring system, and you have probably interface like is a car-like object or something like this. You are making interfaces for your domain. In Haskell, we usually don't do this. We really don't use type classes that much for our domain objects. We have these extra general type classes like functors. Functor is basically, it has only one method inside, which is called fmap. This is exactly the same as map function. You have used map in plenty of the exercises already. Map is a, you give it a function that converts A to B, and it converts a list of A into list of Bs. So you do something for each element of your list, a bit like for each in Java. Very useful function. Basically all Haskell programs call map at least once, I think. Then we have this map on steroids. It's a fmap. It's the same thing. It takes a function from A to B, and it takes some functor f that contains A's, and it returns some functor f that contains B's. For example, you know, this could be a list. Then it would be the same as ordinary map. So what does this give you? When you program in Haskell, it doesn't really matter what your container is. If you have a binary tree, a vector, a list, you know, maybe, all of this, just if you want to change the contents, you can just use fmap. Works for almost everything. If you have something that contains elements, just you want to change the elements, use fmap. Bang, elements change. Great function. You know, it's also nice that all every case where you use map, you can use fmap also. It works the same for the lists. Very awesome. So how many questions and how much time do we have? I have to select. I think we have time for this question. So functors. Firstly, functors have this certain type signature, the class signature. It's something that has to do with, you know, f of a's. And this f is of the class functor. So question is almost the same as before. Which of these would work? Which of these potentially could be instances for the functor class? And yeah, this is slightly more difficult than the question before, but essentially the same question. Functors also have a set of laws, which are very nice. So you theoretically should, in your head, figure out, do these fulfill the laws as well? But not the most important point here. And, you know, the most important part, the type signature here. That's the thing that you use to think about this. Antti Juhani is smiling, so I probably have bug here also. Do I have a bug? No. Thank goodness. It's really ominous, you know, stop doing that. Okay, 26 answers, great. So, first impressions, which of these could be? Well, first one, maybe not so sure. Second one, it seems that, yeah, people are mostly thinking, yeah, that's a possible functor. Then this one, mostly yes. Bit less here. Okay. Firstly, you know, what do you do when you want to, you know, check if these are possible? First, you know, can I write that thing, this data type here? Can I write vector here? You know, let's put this this thing here. It's a type, not a type constructor. Doesn't take any parameters. Can I write vector A? Second one, it takes single type parameter, it's a type constructor. So can I write here vector A? Does it make sense? Would it be sensible definition? Similarly for rest of these. After you made this kind of a deduction, which of these crudely fit this pattern, then you figure out if you write, say, vector A here, can you change the vector by using this function? Can you change all the A's in the type into B's? So, for example, here, can we change, say, vector of booleans into vector of ints? Can we change the predicate of A's into predicate, say, predicate of bools into predicate of doubles, for example? And so on. Those two steps, and you know, in teams. Ah, wrong button again. Okay. Short recap of this. First one, yeah, this can't. This does not work. So you can't, fmap over this vector. Basically, you can write a function that goes and changes all of the ints inside this first vector. But what is required of a functor is that you also should be able to change the type. You have to change A's to, I can choose to use this as a, function from ints to bools. And then if I go in and change all of these ints into bools, this data type doesn't work anymore. I can't put a bool here. It's fixed. This field has to be an int. So I can't use this function that changes types to edit this first vector. Second one, yes, this vector A, yeah, it fits the, this type declaration. It's a type constructor like all functors should be. And it's possible for me to, write a method that takes a function, applies this function to all of these individual elements inside this vector. It's very easy thing to do. So that is yes. Then the next two, these are actually, really hard questions. These are very, very hard questions. So can I? One of them, the answer is no, and for the other, yes. So what's going on here? For getting the constraint, fmap is something like this. Now, if I go in and replace this type here, we want bread to be a functor. Yeah, it should be something like this. I get a function that maps A's to B's, and then I should be able to map bread A to bread B. Essentially, what is inside here, this is the only interesting thing inside this data type. So essentially, though not technically, this is the same as, A to an int, and then something like this. If I just crudely replace the essential parts into declaration of fmap. So I get a function that converts an A to a B, a function that converts A to an int, and I need to make a function that converts B to an int. If I want to use, the first deduction, I could make this kind of a function, really. I could make a constant function that returns zero, for example. But that wouldn't fulfill the, functor laws later on. So I can't really make a constant. Usually it's bad smell if I just don't use any of the arguments and return, something totally unrelated. That should, be a warning sign. Then the arguments. Yeah, I get a function that converts A's to an int. That is something I would probably like to use to get the int here. But the problem is I don't have an A. I have no way of, actually getting this A from anywhere. I have a function that would convert A's to B's, but I have no A, so I can't use that either. So this is basically the same type territory as in the four lectures. I can make a broken instance by returning some constant integer from this, but it would not be useful. It would not have the functor laws. Okay, another one. Doing this in the opposite order, we have these int functions. Again, what I'm doing is I'm just basically replacing this ifun in place of f and then putting this int arrow a in place. This is the essential part, not technically correct, but the essential part of what is happening. And now we look at this type. And Nope. We should have B here. And at this point of the course, we should probably have some kind of intuition about, you know, we need to return a function from ints to Bs. We have a function from ints to As, and function to convert an A to a B. So, definitely yes. For example, it would be something like that A to B into A, those are our inputs. How would we define we have this function? We must return that takes the int. And then what do we do? Int to A. Call the second function. This thing here, it's of type A. And, well, then we call this A to B, which takes the A and converts it into a B. So we get an int arrow B. So quite possible. It's difficult to code and speak at the same time. Yeah, here's the implementation. So you can make it. Next question is it a valid functor? Do these functor laws hold? So basically, you know, two laws. One of these laws, the second one, always holds when the first one holds. I mean, this implies this, if the Haskell type system is also enforcing things. So basically, at any point, we only need to check the first one. And if we check the first one, if we A to B, its identity function, then this is equivalent to int to A function. So it will change nothing, and the laws will hold. So why do we have these functor laws? Basic meaning is that fmap is a nice function. It does not change the structure of the object that is mapping over. It only changes the elements inside. So basically, it doesn't reverse your list or doesn't drop elements from your binary tree. It makes as little changes as possible. So you don't have to spend a lot of time thinking in what might happen if I use the fmap. Fmap changes only the elements. Second part is that, fmap, this is an optimization law. If you go over the your list, say, go over it two times. First change it using function g, then change it using function f. Well, if you have a very long list, traversing the list twice is expensive. But we can traverse it once. For each element, we first do G, and then we do F. So, we don't have to go over the list twice. We can just go over it once. So it's basically there for, you can optimize your code. First one is that you don't have to be afraid of the fmap. It does only the obvious thing. Second one is you can collapse traversals over lists into one traversal. That's the meaning of the laws. Okay. We are running slightly over time. So basically this section, if you did already do the convert to JSON exercise, the last type class exercise, and if you run into a big troubles with that exercise, here's the trick that you have to use. Otherwise, we change the exercise to be slightly easier, so you don't need the trick. But if you are currently doing that exercise and have troubles, the exercise was this to JSON exercise, then here's how you solve the exercise. If you haven't done it yet, the new exercise is slightly easier. And next, we are going to talk about I/O. Most of the questions will be about these two operators. These are the big and hard thing that we are coming up. And then we talk a little bit about the do notation, which is actually very easy. So these are the things that should be done for the next round. Okay, any questions? Anything you want to comment? If not, then go and fill out the survey and, you know, see you tomorrow at the supervised sessions. Okay, I don't have anything more, so have a nice evening.